From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made yesterday in Washington, where a federal judge rejected a request to block construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline. The judge turned down the motion based on grounds of religious freedom. And the judge added that there would be risk of immediate harm. There would be no risk of immediate harm until oil starts flowing at least. Well, the attorney for Dakota Access says they're going to work quickly to get that oil flowing, and that could happen within 30 days now. He told reporters, quote, "The company is moving as quickly as it can to complete the pipeline to make up for lost time over the last few months," end quote. So let's back up for a moment over the last few months. On December 4th, Assistant Army Secretary for Civil Affairs Joe Ellen Darcy decided not to allow the pipeline to be built, in part because she says alternate routes need to be considered first. Energy Transfer Partners called that decision politically motivated and accused President Barack Obama's administration of delaying the matter until he left office. President-elect Trump had promised to greenlight the project as soon as he could. And he did. President Trump issued orders to allow for both the Dakota Access Pipeline and the Keystone XL Pipeline, and he says he hasn't heard any complaints, which is odd, because there have been tens of thousands of Americans protesting. That doesn't mean that no one wants these projects completed, of course, but it does mean that the president is ignoring any opposing views right now. So we reached out to those who have taken the time to demonstrate and have a passionate interest in this subject. And our guests for the hour include Michael Galbin, who's curator and historian at the Seneca Art and Culture Center at Ganondagan. Michael, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Evan.
Ben Miller Jacobson's here. He's visited Standing Rock, and we'll be able to talk about that experience. And Ben, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Evan.
And Sue Hughes-Smith is here, a co-leader of the Rochester People's Climate Coalition, and was at Standing Rock not too long ago. Sue, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
I want to start just by listening to what President Trump had to say. ABC News has this sound clip of the president at the White House talking about both pipelines, the Keystone XL pipeline and the Dakota Access Pipeline, and listen to how he characterizes the idea that there might be some concern or protest or complaint about it. Let's listen.
You know, I approved two pipelines that were stuck in limbo forever. I don't even think it was controversial. You know, I approved them. I haven't even heard. I haven't had one call from anybody saying, oh, that was a terrible thing you did. I haven't had one call. You know, usually if I do something, it's like bedlam, right? I haven't had one call from anybody. And, you know, we've got a lot of jobs. In the Keystone case, we have potentially 32,000 jobs almost immediately. And then, as you know, I did the Dakota pipeline, and nobody called up to complain because it was unfair. Years of getting approvals, nobody showed up to fight it. This company spends a tremendous hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, and then all of a sudden people show up to fight it. Not fair to our companies, and I think everyone's going to be happy in the end, okay?
Everyone's going to be happy. No calls, no complaints, not controversial. I just want to remind our listeners that the media is often accused of living in a bubble. Okay, maybe the White House is in a bit of a bubble because, of course, there have been complaints. Michael Galbin, when you hear that from the president, what do you think?
It doesn't surprise me. It just seems like a tactic of this administration to just confuse and create a fog of confusion over what is truth and what is real. And you know, I can't really explain, you know, what the impact, or I can't really estimate what kind of impact he does have. But if his statement gets broadcast, I mean, a lot of people just aren't going to investigate any further, and they're just going to believe what he had said. And it's responsibility of the media, really, to, you know, expose the truth. And hopefully that's what we're doing. And these actions that people are, and demonstrations that people are participating in, is a clear indication that there is a lot of opposition to these projects.
Sure. And before I go to the other panelists, I will say to our listeners directly, you know, first of all, if you're the type, if you're the kind of person who says, wait a second, I think these pipelines, maybe they will create jobs. Maybe we should get more oil flowing. If you're in that category, and there's plenty of Americans who probably feel that way, call the program, let us know. Let's have a conversation about it. We'll listen. We'll talk. Hopefully you'll listen. 844-295-TALK. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. We reached out in various ways trying to find people to join this program in studio with us who are kind of ardent supporters of these projects in the same way that our guests here in the studio might be opponents of them. We didn't have success with that, but we'd love to hear from you if you want to call the program. I will also say this about the president. It's one thing to say, look, I've listened to the protesters. I've had conversations with people from various backgrounds. I think these projects could go through. I know a lot of people are unhappy. We're going to try to do our best to make sure the projects are safe and beneficial. We're listening, but we're still going to do it. If it's one thing to say that, it's another to say this is not controversial and there hasn't even been one complaint. I mean, that's just not living in reality. And Ben Miller Jacobson, what do you think when you hear the president saying this is not controversial? There hasn't been one call, no complaints.
Well, sometimes it's hard to tell whether he's honestly drinking his own Kool-Aid about this sort of thing, or if he is just so completely uncaring about, you know, outside reality and truth and so on that he doesn't understand there's any repercussions for just saying things that anyone paying attention will see as false. And in this case, definitely anyone paying attention will notice there's been a great deal of opposition, a great deal of controversy. And whichever side you happen to fall on, it shouldn't be controversial that there is controversy.
Yeah, right. But yeah, I think that's exactly the point I'm making. I don't think it's a biased statement to say, of course there's controversy. Of course there have been protests. And of course the president should be able to at least acknowledge that. But I don't, you know, he has said he watches Fox News often in the morning. He uses Breitbart. He uses InfoWars. And I don't know that they've been reporting on these subjects. So maybe he is not aware. I mean, I don't know if he's aware or not. And to Ben's point, I don't know if he's intentionally missing it, if he truly doesn't know. But he clearly is not showing that he's aware or cares to be aware. Sue, what do you think when you hear those statements from the president?
Well, I think they're blatantly false. As you say, I can't speak to whether he's ignorant or he's deliberately misleading, because I don't know the man. But certainly when you shut down the comment lines at the White House, it's kind of hard to then claim that no one's calling. You do need to answer the phone. And they shut down the online submissions for comments to the Army Corps. So you have to be willing to hear people.
Yeah. Well, let's grab our first phone call. And what we're going to talk about this hour is a number of things. What comes next? What our panelists hope to come next? Are they going back to Standing Rock? We will talk about how this ties into the questions on climate policy. And I know all of our guests, Sue in particular, that's been a big question. But let me grab our first phone call, and it's Tom in Rochester. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, I've worked on a few pipelines, and it seems like the Alaskan pipeline has a double pipe. One has got the oil and another is around it as a protector with monitors in it. So I think that the XL and the Dakota should both be double pipes, especially going under a reservoir and the other one going over an aquifer. And maybe all pipelines should have a double pipe because when they leak, they make a really big mess. It takes years to clean them up.
So you're saying that the double piping to you is a way to make sure it's sound, protected, safe, yes?
The Alaskan pipeline supposedly has two pipes, one with the oil and one with a big protector around it.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can look at things like fracking. I mean, there are things that they do to try to seal, casing, all kinds of things. And for the most part, Tom, I think energy companies understand that if they had a 50% failure rate, if they had a 25% failure rate, they'd be out of business. So they probably do have a lot in place to try to make sure it's as safe as possible. Sue Hugh Smith, is that good enough for you?
Well, I think the evidence demonstrates that it's not good enough. On average, pipelines in this country break every 1.7 days. So there are...
Wait. Yeah. Not every pipeline every 1.7 days. Every 1.7
there
days, there's
pipeline.
A pipeline break somewhere.
In
That's
the U.S., okay. Every 1.7 days. So it is, to some extent, the course of business that there will be pipelines and that these pipelines will break. And there are always promises that, oh, those are going to be identified really quickly and those spills will be cleaned up really quickly. But that often is not the case. For example, Kalamazoo. In 2010, there was a pipeline that burst in the river there. It's still being cleaned up today. The company didn't know that it was leaking for over 7 hours, despite, you know, supposedly having all the latest technology and so forth. So people have good reason to be concerned that their drinking water will be contaminated because it happens all the time.
And that is an environmental look. But Michael Galvin, when it comes to what the tribes in that part of our country are talking about, there's also sovereignty. There are treaties that go back decades, hundreds of years. And so what are the issues in play for you? When you hear Tom say, look, these pipelines are built to be as safe as possible, what do you say to that?
Well, it's clear that the pipelines they're not 100% foolproof. It's obvious that the facts are undeniable, right? So what is the question? The question is then, you know, how is it that these pipelines are able to continue to be built and maintained, you know, in whatever way? So they've balanced out the impact environmentally, cleanup, whatever they have to do, especially lacking any kind of repercussions, monetary or otherwise. It just makes business sense to keep putting them in and keep pushing oil. And when they break, have very little repercussions, do what minimum mitigation you have to do to satisfy the people involved and move on. And it's just clear. That's the way these corporations are run. And in terms of native issues, it's an issue related to the erosion of sovereignty, the erosion of your ability to self-determine, threatening your community environmentally and with public health issues, threatening your ability to function as an autonomous people with your own belief system and your own way of seeing the world and protecting your land, which the Lakota people still regard those lands as their own and continue to, make sure that the land will be there for their future generations. You know, these are issues that extend beyond just the dollars that are being either lost or gained, however this plays out. It deals a lot with how we can function in the future as Native people.
Yeah, Michael, your friend and colleague Peter Jemison told us on this program recently that, you know, when the Obama administration, in its waning days at the end of last year, he said this is a test of whether treaties still matter, whether we still honor them. Do you view it that way?
Absolutely. The United States enters into treaty negotiations and signs treaties with other sovereign nations. And as according to federal law, treaty law is the supreme law of the land. And this is a country, the United States is a country built on laws. And yet, Native people who have sought justice in the court system and attempt to use these laws to protect their interests have historically been denied. And we see that in the most recent statement by the federal judge with the Cheyenne River Sioux people. And it was an interesting case because they chose to use religious freedom as the linchpin of their argument, in that they want to protect the water, in that they can continue to perform their ceremonies with pure water as they always had since time immemorial. And the federal judge, sort of in a matter of semantics, said that, well, the objection is really with the oil passing through the line, not really the line. So until the oil begins to pass, we're going to let this continue. Which is really interesting to note that a federal judge feels confident enough in the Lakota spirituality and belief system to be able to decide whether or not it is a violation of their religious freedoms. That's crazy. It's also crazy that this particular federal judge has very little understanding of federal Indian law, which he declared publicly when they went before him many months ago. He said that he would have to do a little studying on federal Indian law. People have built their careers trying to understand federal Indian law, and this fellow was going to do a little studying.
One more quick comment or question for Michael Galbin, and then I want to hear what Ben has to say on this. The phone lines are all lit up, which is, you know, a lot of people very interested in this subject. Michael, when it comes to religious freedom, do you have a concern that that really means Judeo-Christian, that means, you know, religion that reflects the power holders in this country? Or if we're going to have religious freedom and respect for all religions, should there be a better effort to understand, for example, as you said, the tribes and what they're talking about?
Yeah, it's hard to imagine a case being brought before a federal judge on behalf of a Judeo-Christian, doctrine being interpreted by a non-member federal judge It would be really hard for me to imagine that kind of decision being valid. But when it comes to Native peoples and it comes to our beliefs, we're not, we don't receive the same kind of justice and the same kind of recognition as others. It's just a fact.
Ben Miller-Jacobson, again, has visited Standing Rock. You heard the caller, Tom, says, that he's worked on pipelines and that we've got double-line pipes that are going to be as safe as possible. Does that move you at all, Ben?
That really doesn't. Once again, it's a business decision for the companies running and creating the pipelines, exactly how much safety to use. And no doubt they are weighing the expected costs of various approaches and trying to, rather than optimize for how safe it is, optimize for how little money they spend plus the amount that they're fined. They want to avoid being fined, but only to the extent that it doesn't cost them too much money for the safety precautions. But also, this is only in part about the safety of the pipelines, really. The native sovereignty issue is a very important one, and well, there's also a larger argument to be made about how much money is being invested in production of new oil sources in the U.S. right now, and whether we should instead be concentrating on expanding renewable energy. That's probably a different discussion than this, though.
Well, and I think that ties into one of our callers, Rich in Rochester, who we just lost, but Rich wanted to call in and make the point that if we don't have the pipeline and we have to use trains, wouldn't that be a more dangerous way to transport oil? And Sue, what would you say to someone like Rich who says, if we're going to move the oil, is this a better way to do it?
Right. So I've been working with Mothers Out Front specifically on the Bakken oil train issue since 2014. And there's no doubt that having this material flowing through basically a virtual pipeline, which is the rails, is not safe. But pipelines aren't any safer. And that's a myth that is purported by the companies that want the pipelines, and they want the pipelines because it's cheaper. Much, much cheaper for them to do business that way, but they are not safer. And I just want to make that point. According to the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, just since 2010, there have been over 3,300 incidents of crude oil and gas spills and leaks from pipelines, killing 80, injuring 389, and costing more than $2.8 billion in damages, which, of course, is not primarily paid for by the industry, but is mostly paid for through taxpayer cleanup.
But, Sue, with, mm-hmm. with Rich saying, okay, maybe pipelines are safer than trains, you're saying the evidence doesn't support that. Then what's the solution here? Use less oil?
Use less oil. And so long as we are building more and more fossil fuel infrastructure, we will keep using more and more fossil fuels. So we have to get serious and we have to stop drilling new wells and start allowing the wells we have to deplete, and while doing so, put in place renewable supplies.
Listeners, I just want to direct your attention to what's coming up at noon tomorrow, by the way. If you are maybe a conservative hearing Sue saying, come on, or if you're even if you're someone who's self-identifies as a progressive saying, unfortunately, we're never going to make this progress. Tomorrow in the noon hour, you're going to hear about a group of Republicans, a group of GOP leaders, James Baker and many others who've put together this group lobbying the White House and Congress on a carbon tax, saying we are serious about climate change. Mm-hmm. And we think there are things that we can do, and we're going to have that conversation tomorrow at noon. That's led by Republicans. So what Sue is talking about, this idea of use less oil, build less infrastructure, is not just an idea from the left. I wanted to say that. Back to the phones we go, and Ingrid in Penfield. Go ahead, Ingrid.
Hi, Evan. I feel bad that I called in because I don't want to distract from the discussion about the pipeline. I just wanted to say, please don't function as an apologist for 45, even if he gets all of his news from Breitbart and InfoWars. It's not an excuse for saying that there's no controversy about these things. Mm-hmm. It's equally egregious if he's ignorant or if he's lying. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Ingrid. I agree with that. I was simply saying that it's impossible for me to know if he's outright lying, saying that there's no controversy, there's no calls, there's no protests, there's no complaints. Or if he just doesn't know. Ingrid is saying it doesn't matter, it's a problem either way. I don't necessarily disagree. If you're the most powerful person in the world, it would probably behoove you to have good information about everything. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Ingrid, a point well made there. Betsy in Brighton next up. Go ahead, Betsy.
Hi, I'm calling because I think it's a false thing that they're saying. When they're talking about these pipelines, it is the Heritage Foundation is a big proponent who's writing legislation for the Congress, and they're solely funded by the Koch brothers, who have a vested interest in expanding the oil industry because that's where they make their money. And if you've read the book, Dark Money by Jane Mayer, you'll see that they have quoted in saying that they don't care about the infrastructure of the pipelines because it's cheaper to pay off a lawsuit than it is to repair a pipeline. And most of this oil and gas is going for export. It's not going for national use, so it's a false argument saying that we need the energy. Mm-hmm. It's that they want to pump out as much as they can to make as much money as possible from the gas that we have in our country before the natural occurrence of switching over to renewables, which is the way things have to go. And also, when they say that it provides jobs, that's also a false argument because the contractors are brought in from out of state. They're there for a very short time, and it provides no boost to the economy long term.
Betsy, thank you for the phone call. Got it all in just about one breath there. Before I let the panel respond to that, I know David in Rochester was on a similar point, so I'll let David also jump in, and then the panel can respond. Go ahead, David.
Well, Betsy took the job thing, the job argument. Like in fracking, there are some jobs that are created to put infrastructure in place, and then it's almost zip because it takes very little to maintain them. The other question I have is... without much effort, that pipeline that they're going to build could have been under Bismarck, coincidentally, not that far away, coincidentally, an all-white, very Republican city. Anyway, that's my comment. I'll listen offline.
All right, David, thank you very much. Michael Galbin, what do you think?
It was clearly not wanted by the community of Bismarck, and so... they looked at what would be the easiest solution, and they said, oh, well, we'll just roll it past these native people on their lands or near their lands and through their waters. And, it's just another example of our, lack of a voice in national policy, federal policy, environmental issues.
Okay. Ben?
Exactly. It was a well-made point. The people of Bismarck didn't want it, so where was the next place they could move it? A little farther downstream with where it would have been going through land of people they didn't care about as much. And not that it going through Bismarck would have been all that much better, except from the native sovereignty angle, because that is still upstream, that still is potentially tremendously destructive to the entire Missouri River. But it is illustrative that they made that choice. And then on the previous comment with the jobs argument being spurious and so on, there does seem to be a lot of outright propaganda around that sort of thing. And when I was at Standing Rock, I visited Bismarck several times for supplies. There did seem to be a sense on the ground there that a lot of people were sort of cautiously supporting the pipeline, thinking it would yield jobs, but I think they've been tricked.
Let me get a little pushback from a listener named Leah, who's an attorney, regarding the judge that Michael Galbin was talking about. Here's what Leah writes, quote, "Judges never stop having to learn about the law. No lawyer does, either. Jewish judges decide Christian questions, and vice versa, all the time. It is the litigant attorney's job to educate the judge so that he or she can understand what his client needs the judge to know to decide the case fairly. That's what lawyers do, and that's what judges expect from them. That's our system. Let's hope it is not the case, as your panel member suggests, that those not raised in a certain culture can't understand enough about it to treat it fairly. I don't think that's the case." That's from Leah. Michael Galbin?
Yeah, I understand her point, and yet my objection is not that they did not provide enough information and maybe the judge dismissed it, or I don't know the specifics of what testimony was actually given, But it's surprising to me when the judge can tell and inform the Lakota people that their objection is unfounded in terms of their religious beliefs. That, to me, seems totally incredible.
Yeah, and Leah, I would say, first of all, thanks for the email. I agree with the sentiment, or at least the hope, that anybody from a background that is not the same as someone who is maybe presenting a case to them in court or working with them in business. We all have to try to understand one another's differences. And absolutely, lawyers, judges have a responsibility to try to understand that. I feel like what I'm hearing from Michael Galban, and as a white guy in the room, the guy who tries to just listen at times, is when I listen to Native people talk about this, it feels like if there were 100 cases regarding Native beliefs and 100 cases regarding Judeo-Christian beliefs, guess who's going to get the short end of it? That's sort of the point, is that, you know, when you look at the wide range of this, this has been happening to Native people for decades and centuries now. And this just feels like another mark in invalidating a belief system. Michael, is that fair?
That's pretty much what I'm saying, yeah. Okay. I mean, historically, we have been in the short end of the stick in terms of seeking justice with law in the United States. It is just a historic fact. And to totally disregard a people and their concerns and religious concerns, you know, is absolutely horrible and inexcusable.
Okay. Sue?
Yeah, thanks, Evan. I just want to add a little bit to the religious discussion, mm-hmm. because it's not, it's much more complex than we like to acknowledge. There are Native people who follow their Native traditions at the same time they are adherents or participants in Judeo-Christian tradition. I traveled in December out to Standing Rock with an interfaith group led by the Rochester Episcopal Diocese. And we went in support of and to support the Episcopal priest who is and has been in Standing Rock for decades. And Native communities on the plains can be anywhere from 25% to 75% Episcopalian. So it is more nuanced than what we often discuss. Mm-hmm. And we need to respect the people's belief systems when they are coming forward and saying this is a sacred site to us, that should hold weight. That shouldn't be determined by someone else saying, oh, that is or isn't a sacred site to you. And as Father Floberg showed us when we arrived, the sacred mounds, you know, there are any number of bluffs the police could have set up on to defend the pipeline. But they chose to stand on the most sacred ground that the Native peoples had agreed never to fight on, mm-hmm. to not have weapons on. And it's a clear violation when the police, with their weapons, go onto that land. And so it just shows a fundamental disrespect.
All right, let's get our only break of the hour. You're hearing Sue Hugh Smith, who's co-leader of the Rochester People's Climate Coalition and has been to Standing Rock. You were last there. When were you there, Sue?
In December,
so mm-hmm. just a couple of months ago. Michael Galban's curator and historian at the Seneca Art and Culture Center at Ganondagan. Ben Miller Jacobson has also visited Standing Rock. They're our panelists in studio. I will tell you again, listeners, if you're someone who you want to push back a little, you support these projects, maybe you've got more questions or comments that you don't think have been addressed yet, feel free to call the program, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. When we come back, we're going to listen to David Archambault, who is he's the person you see most often. He's the Standing Rock Sioux Tribal Council Chair, and we're going to hear from him and let you know when he's coming to our area this week, by the way. So that's right after this break on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, Rochester is going to reaffirm its status as a sanctuary city next week if City Council passes a new resolution that would update a 1986 resolution. But what exactly does it mean to be a sanctuary city? Who does it impact? And can Rochester be a sanctuary city without inciting the Trump administration to try to block federal funds or otherwise? So let's talk about it. We'll explain next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I want to listen to what David Archambault said on Amy Goodman's show, Democracy Now!, responding to some of President Trump's comments about allowing the Dakota Access Pipeline and the Keystone XL Pipeline to go forward. So this is David from that program just a few days ago.
I don't think any leader of a nation should make decisions without hearing all perspectives. And that if you're not doing that, you're a surrogate and you're going to base your decision off of who's telling you what to do.
You haven't spoken with the Trump administration?
No, I haven't. And I set up a meeting for today just to meet with Intergovernmental Affairs. We've been trying for the ever since the election, and no one would listen to it. No one will meet with us. Finally, we got a meeting. It was scheduled for Monday this week, and then it got pushed to today. So I came in to get this meeting done and let them hear our side and why are we standing up against this pipeline? What is the cause? And it's important for you as a decision maker to understand why there is a movement, why we are standing up, so you can respond. But
they canceled
it never
this.
Happened.
Yeah, so he says it never happened. So there's Archambault saying they can't even really get heard. And you've got President Trump, Michael Galban, saying that it would be unfair to companies who have already spent millions of dollars on this pipeline to allow any more hesitation with this. What do you make of that?
Well, I don't want to get bogged down on the confusion of the Trump administration and distraction from the issue. We've spent a lot of time thinking about, you know, what he knows, what he doesn't know, how he gets his information, whether he's saying truth or lie, you know, and it just sort of confuses the situation and distracts from the real points, you know. And if we could, I could just take a second here.
Sure.
You know, when we talk about law and Native people and religious rights, it is a fact that up until 1978, within my lifetime, Native people did not have the same protections of religious freedom as other people in the United States. That's 1978. And in accordance with that law, we have a right to access our sacred sites and a right to have them protected, a right to perform our sacred ceremonies, and access to the materials required. And some of these lands are those, in fact, those places. So this is in violation of the our Religious Freedom Act, a recent act. You know, we're starting from a real deficit. You know, it's not totally, I think that the choice to select that argument legally was not a, you know, not take, was very considerate and testing what is really federal law. And we can see by the federal judge's decision that that law does not matter.
Sue, you want to weigh in on that as well?
Yeah, just to the extent that this is just more of a of a series of injustices that have occurred, right? When the Army Corps initially determined where they were going to allow the pipeline, they were supposed to consult with the tribe. They sent one letter. They did not answer three requests from Dave Archambault to meet with them. So in a sense, it's the Army Corps insisting on doing things their way without regard to the ways in which the indigenous leaders operate and function, and an unwillingness to respect their ways and properly have that consultation.
All right, and I want to mention that David Archambault is coming to Cornell. So we just got this release this morning. Michael said you didn't even realize he was coming. Is that right?
Yeah, I was unaware.
So this is news to you as well. So this is news to a lot of people. This just came down this Thursday. So Thursday, down on the Ithaca campus of Cornell at Stocking Hall, from 3:30 to 4:30, David's going to be there again, chairman of the Standing Rock Sioux Nation, for a presentation titled Standing Rock, the Violation of Indigenous People's Rights. It's a seminar and presentation, and again, it's going to be about an hour long. It's open to the public, and so that comes to us from Cornell University. A media advisory just came down this morning. And I imagine he's a very busy guy, so a chance to hear from him directly. But I guess, Michael, when you say you don't want to take your eye off the most important issues, you don't want to get distracted, but I think it's fair to keep pointing out to people that this administration in the White House is not even meeting, or people involved, the biggest stakeholders there, don't feel like they can even be heard. That's relevant, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess I would have to agree with that, but that's a tactic that they've been using in all different issues, economic, social, whatever. I'd just like to point out that it's not true and move on.
Okay. Point taken. Before we get back to your phone calls, let me just hit, I think, a point that has come up in a couple of ways this hour, but probably should be addressed again, and I'll go around the table on this. Sue, when it comes to the larger question on climate policy, this administration, when Donald Trump was a candidate, he said Keystone's going to happen if I'm elected, that Dakota Access is going to happen if I'm elected. And clearly tens of millions of people believe that you've got to move the needle on people's beliefs about these projects. Now, before the hour began, we talked about the fact that if you poll things like Dakota Access or Keystone, there are plenty of people who say they're for it. I don't necessarily know how much they're thinking about it. I think they just think more oil, more access, sure. But how do you start to move the needle if your side, so to speak, is going to win on this? How are you going to move the needle here? And are you frustrated that maybe it's not moving as fast as you want?
Well, of course I'm frustrated. We needed to move on this way back in the 90s. So, to some extent, this is just more of the same and a step backward for sure. But we haven't had real climate policy ever implemented in this country, and we certainly need to. The legal system, as it's written, is established to make it easy to bring products to market, and this is a legal product. So you really have a couple of choices. You either have to ban the product and make it illegal, or you need to change the underlying economics of the situation. And that's what a carbon tax is seeking to do, because this industry is operating outside the normal boundaries of capitalism in that they take all the profits and they externalize all the costs, and society is paying those costs. So we have to fix that market. So hopefully we'll get a carbon tax.
Well, that's what we're going to talk about tomorrow, again, with Republican leadership pushing for that. Republican leadership that's generally not in Congress anymore, which might be an easier time to advocate for a carbon tax, as it turns out, but that's what's happening. Michael Galbin, what do you think of efforts, to again make that same kind of progress that Sue is talking about, if we're going to combat climate change and if we're going to really diversify and start shifting our energy sources?
I kind of get the sense that these projects and the tar sands and fracking and these pipelines is sort of the last gasp of the fossil fuel industry trying to collect as much revenue as they possibly can and exhaust our natural resources to the very bitter end before we inevitably switch to a more sustainable energy policy. I feel like that's what we're combating, really. And they already have such vast resources to push through these projects, whether it's through lobbying or litigation. They have the support of law enforcement. They have support of militarized law enforcement. These entities which are combining resources to push these through, it seems like almost inevitable. But we must resist, and for the protection of the land and for our future generations' well-being and health, we are living in the times that were told long ago that would happen to our environment, sometimes to the better, many times to the worse. And I think that that's a big part of what people are fighting against.
Okay, Ben?
I think that capitalism always tries to get away with not dealing with externalities. And left to its own devices in the case of fossil fuels, we can expect to see every last drop extracted until it becomes unprofitable to do so. by whatever means are necessary. If we allow that to happen, then well, then it's just a matter of, you know, how many aquifers and rivers are tainted in the process, how much coastline we lose, how many millions of people die in the resulting modifications to our climate and weather systems. That's not acceptable to me, and that shouldn't be acceptable to anyone else. I think what it's going to take to change that is a mass movement powerful enough to make it unprofitable to try to do that and to make it harder to push forward along that plan than to learn to do without and focus on renewables. And I think that what we've seen in Standing Rock is a good step in the right direction, but there's quite a bit of work to do still.
Yeah. So go ahead.
Yeah, and one other note, Evan, about jobs. Because generally I think when people are polled, they are asked if they're in favor of pipelines, and people are in favor of them because they think it creates jobs. So just a couple facts from the Department of Energy. You know, last year there were 173,000 solar jobs in the United States, and there were 10,000 pipeline construction jobs. So if we care about jobs, we need to care about renewable energy, because that's where the jobs are.
All right, back to the phones we go. Sean in Rochester next. Go ahead, Sean.
Hi. I think Ben just touched on what I was going to say a little bit, but I guess there's a question and comment. What do the panelists think about the fight back in Standing Rock and what happened there as a example of the solidarity that we need to be able to win any games against the forces that are trying to pollute our land, take away indigenous rights, and capitalize on the profits for the profits of few against us all. And I think at Standing Rock we saw through the leadership of the Native Americans and their resistance, so many different people coming together from all walks of life and from all areas of the country coming together and showing that we need a multiracial mass movement and struggle to win any benefits or any gains. And that's the only way to move forward. We're going to have some wins. We're going to have some losses. But we need to see Standing Rock and what happened in late December or early December as a victory and an example of how we can move forward to really try to fight back and struggle against the policies that can destroy our earth and put our indigenous rights in jeopardy.
Sean, thanks for the phone call. I want to start with Michael Galvin on that and shift that question looking forward now. What do you expect to happen at Standing Rock, assuming that judges continue to greenlight this, the Trump administration is going to make sure that this is greenlighted, that this attempts to go forward? What do you think is going to happen there, Michael?
Well, as I understand it, the nations which are impacted and are directly involved in the resistance, Standing Rock community, Cheyenne River, and the Oglala Nation are going to continue to file in federal court objections looking for delays. At this point, any delay is a good delay because delays cost money. And that's where the real battle takes place, in the pocketbook of these corporations. We've seen some cooperation with cities pulling money from Wells Fargo, which is a big contributor to the project. Seattle, for example, and Davis in California, that has an impact. When the money is being pulled away, that does have an impact. I also am really encouraged by all the Native people and support from all the different, just dozens of nations coming together, solidified in support and solidarity. That is a beautiful thing. Disregard the non-Native people who've stood in support. He's right. We do need this coalition of nations, a coalition of like-minded. Next month on March 10th, as I understand it, there's a call to march on Washington based on this issue. So they have called for Native people to coalesce and make their presence known and have their voice heard right in Washington, D.C.
Okay. Ben, some thoughts on what Sean had to say?
All right. I think that Dave Archambault represents a particular tendency. He's been in favor of approaches focusing on legal challenges, letting the system work, and so on. And that's certainly not the only viewpoint present there, and certainly not the predominant one on the ground when I was there last. And instead, I think that of the sort of mass multiracial solidarity built on genuine respect that Sean was describing is going to be key in the way forward. I think that at this point, the legal challenges are one of the less important aspects of this. And instead, continued resistance on the ground and with various solidarity demonstrations, pushes for divestment from banks involved in energy transfer partners, and that mass march and so on are going to be key going forward.
Okay. Sue Hughes-Smith?
I absolutely agree with the caller. I mean, we have to stand united. The strategy is always to try to distract us amongst ourselves, and respect for one another and our views is absolutely crucial.
Dan writes to the program on the subject of divestment that Ben was just talking about. Dan says, is Rochester or Monroe County invested in any pipeline-affiliated banks? I don't know the answer to that, Dan. Does anybody in state? I don't know offhand. Yeah, sorry, Dan. I can try to dig into that for you off air and sort of outside of the show hours, but I wish I had a good answer. I don't. And I want to squeeze in an answer to Alan's question. He sent an email. Alan sent a lengthy email essentially saying, Evan, your panel is talking about companies that might almost create a formula to figure out, is it more profitable to do X or Y, even if that means more spills, more environmental harm, more human cost? And Alan's saying, you just can't believe that's true. And I would just say this, Alan, I'm going to be careful not to speak too much about something I sort of know about but don't know that much about. But my first job was in West Virginia. I covered the coal industry there. In fact, I was in a helicopter flying over West Virginia many times. And the first few times you do it, you say, wow, there are these beautiful lakes in the distance, the sun bouncing off them. But they are not lakes. They are slurry impoundments. So when you mine coal, there's waste rock. They take that waste rock that's not coal, and they make a dam in the valley. And then they fill up the valley with slurry, which is they're using water combined with chemicals to clean the coal. And that resulting sludge has got to go somewhere. It fills up. And the biggest one that I covered in 2002, 7 billion gallons. And there, look it up, jump online and look up the October 2000 slurry impoundment blowout. 200 miles of waterways, everything killed in those waterways, big blowout there. So I remember talking to somebody at one of these impoundments saying, can't you do something different? Does it have to be slurry? And he said, sure, yeah, we could dry it. There's other things we could do. And I said, okay, you doing it? And he said, no, that's more money. This is the profitable way to do it, even if that means once in a while these things blow out in hundreds of miles of waterway. That's what I was told as a young reporter. Now, again, do I know all the processes? No. Take your own research on that. But I was told at 23 years old, I'm going, wow, they've got a calculation on this. So, Sue, you kind of talked about that they understand what could happen. And yes, there are some business decisions made. It makes us uncomfortable, but it does happen.
Oh, absolutely.
I'm not saying everyone's evil. I'm not saying there's no good people in these companies. I'm saying it does happen.
Of course. It's a business, and from their perspective, they're running a business. So they want to, minimize costs and optimize profits. And the cost of human lives isn't part of that calculation, or our comfort or our preference for clean water and so forth.
All right, 30 seconds, Michael Galbin. Do you have any hope going forward on these kind of projects? I mean, are you feeling sort of up or down about this right now?
It's an uphill battle. But I think whenever people stand up together and in solidarity, we can affect change.
I want to thank you for being here, all of our panelists. You just heard Michael Galbin, curator and historian at the Seneca Art and Culture Center at Ganondagan. Thank you, Michael. Great having you here.
Thanks, Evan.
Ben Miller-Jacobson, nice to sharing your perspective both here and from Standing Rock. Thank you for being here, Ben.
Thank you, Evan.
And Sue Hughes-Smith, co-leader of the Rochester People's Climate Coalition. Thank you, Sue.
Thank you, Evan.
All right, short break. If you've ever wondered what it really means to be a sanctuary city, we're going to try to answer that next.